Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
On this episode of Black's History Week, Professor Jeremy Black, author of Geopolitics and the Quest for Dominance, talks to The Critic's deputy editor, Graham Stewart, about where Russia's invasion of Ukraine leaves American and European strategic priorities.
Well, currently we are, Graham and myself, we're talking on Monday the 14th, and therefore our comments should be taken as relevant to that period. Nobody can know what might happen in a moment, and that's the very nature of military and diplomatic history. There are multiple unpredictabilities, which is one of the reasons why people that pretend that history has a clear-cut pattern are so misleading. If one looks at where we are today compared to where we were when we last made a programme last week, the major changes have occurred not in Ukraine itself, but elsewhere in the world. And indeed, these are highly pertinent to the general strategic issues surrounding the Ukraine war. In particular, there has been what can be seen, whether it's uncoordinated, which is most likely to be the case, or whether there is some degree of coordination, which is less likely, but nevertheless must be borne in mind. There has been a testing of American and more generally Western interests elsewhere in the world. And in particular, the most volatile state yet again, even more volatile than President Putin's Russia, has emerged as North Korea, which has resumed dangerous testing, in this case of intercontinental ballistic missiles. On top of that, yesterday, Iran fired missiles at the capital of Iraqi Kurdistan, where there is an American base, and fired it, as far as we can see, deliberately at that base. And this was a new development because in the past, when the Iranians have fired missiles, they have used, as it were, protégés, Iraqi militias. This was a direct attack on the United States. Now, all of these may seem a long way away from the terrible plight of the people in Ukraine, more particularly as quite barbaric means of war, for example, white phosphorus, are used by the Russians, and with great grim foreboding that the situation will get even worse. But in practice, as far as strategy is concerned, they are directly relevant to it because they affect the capability and potential of Western powers to act in a deterrent fashion, and particularly the United States. Because much that has been talked about in terms of military action or pseudo-military action or risking military responses, whether in terms of no-fly zones or in terms indeed of other matters, are clearly affected by the global pressure on the United States. Indeed, to put it mildly, much of the recent criticism of the United States in recent years and much of the recent talking about how Europe can have an independent military and political profile of its own looks rather foolish in light of the clear dependence on the United States in order both to act as a deterrent vis-a-vis Russia, and also in order to try and influence or hope to influence other powers, principally China, to exercise some degree of activity itself. Now, I think it's very clear that these are very difficult times. Now, clearly, from the perspective of these additional American commitments, the perspective on Ukraine looks different. And indeed, I think it's fair to say that in particular, the North Korean one is resonant of the situation that has been apparent from President Obama onwards, the idea that there was a tilt towards the Asia-Pacific area. Indeed, I think it's fair to say one could see that tendency as longer lasting in American strategy. And with the assumption accordingly that the Europeans should play the principal role militarily in their own space. That in many senses was one of the reasons for American support over the last two decades for both the expansion of NATO into Eastern Europe and indeed of the European Union, but also successive American governments have been sympathetic to the idea of European federalism of some type or other, because of, in light of Henry Kissinger's famous remark about wanting to have a single phone number to ring and get Europe as a response. Now, I think it's fair to say that there has always been a mismatch. And indeed, if one thinks back to the last major crisis involving conflict of a large scale in Europe, including humanitarian issues of major importance, which was the ones in Yugoslavia, the Bosnian problem of 1994 to 95, and the Kosovo problem of 1999, I think it is fair to say that in each case, the Americans, however reluctant, found themselves as having to play the major role because they were able to deliver the military ordnance to actually give effect to air power support. And they were also able, or best able, to arm local protégés, notably the Croats. Now, the situation is not different at the present moment. In the event of a confrontation with Russia, which is what we have at the present moment, if people listening don't think there is a confrontation, well, of course there is a confrontation, because any danger that the Russians might lean on other states would trigger some sort of need to consider whether NATO still has any force in terms of mutual assistance. That, in practical terms, requires American assistance. It is true that there are two European nuclear powers, Britain and France, but neither of them have the capacity to cope with a nuclear confrontation with Russia, which is only really matched in any respect by America. So at the level of, as it were, strategic confrontation, what the crisis at the present moment underlines is the difficulties facing the United States. For the United States, it will be hard in the face of possible escalating problems with North Korea, endlessly to put Europe foremost. And that, I think, is a difficulty. It may well be the case that Europe remains foremost for a period of time, particularly if large numbers of people are being brutalized, murdered in Ukraine, and if the Russians are taking part in confrontational policies towards other European states, and bombing or missiling, as they did this morning, places close to the Polish border, is clearly understood as a indication that they are willing to act to stop Western arms shipments, which itself carries with it all sorts of consequences in terms of at what point in the means of transmission the Russians intervene. Now, from the perspective of a United States, which is worried about East Asia and where the, as it were, the major power that could really escalate the crisis, which would be a China willing to at least try and intimidate Taiwan or trying to intimidate Japan, or a North Korea angry with the new South Korean government. From the perspective of the United States, all of those are equally highly serious. All of those also pose enormous humanitarian and other difficulties, China attacking Taiwan or North Korea firing missiles at civilian targets would not exactly be cost-free in civilian terms. And whilst European commentators are naturally prone to put Europe first. Possibly they need to understand more the difficulties facing not just this administration, and I think it's fair to say that some people have doubts about President Biden's leadership, but not just this administration, but any administration, because obviously of the multiplicity of complexity facing the United States and the fact that strategy is largely a matter of prioritization. Most people hold up Kissinger, of course, as a advocate of mastery in terms of American foreign policy, but it needs to be remembered that Kissinger had two advantages which are absent at the present day. One, that Russia and China had far worse relationships in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s than is the case today. And secondly, the extent to which it was more possible in the political atmosphere of the Nixon administration and that of Gerald Ford, but particularly the Nixon administration, to, as it were, play realist power politics, whereas today there are more political and public pressures to play, as it were, an idealistic approach to international relations. Well, it looks as though attempts to argue that Kissinger provides an instance of how the Americans should behave these days are not terribly helpful, because Kissinger's context was very difficult. So rewinding to the present day, because it is all too easy for commentators to just range widely in the past, the assumption has to be that on the one hand, you have the tensions for the Russians posed by the difficulties they are encountering in fulfilling their military goals in Ukraine, and the extent to which the timetable clearly is not working from their perspective, partly because of Ukrainian resolve and partly because of Russian deficiencies. That is one timetable. But equally, there is another timetable, that of, and this is highly unpredictable, the strategic pressures building up on the United States as it confronts a range of difficulties. And it is by no means clear which of those timetables is going to prevail, nor is it clear how far the contrary pressures on the United States from allies and from its own geopolitical sense of prioritization are going to be readily reconciled. To put it mildly, not all allies are, as it were, behaving equally in response to the crisis as far as the United States is concerned. The extent to which, in particular, India is, as it were, following a policy of closeness to, or not willing to distance itself from its old patron power and current arms supplier, Russia, it should give the Americans pause for thought. They have played up India as a democracy, which it is, and India as a rival to China, which it indeed is. But it is very clear that the degree to which India is prepared to follow the American lead, or indeed to actually urge people against Russia in this crisis, is very limited. And that should be a matter of note, because were India to be a key part of an anti-China coalition, it has to be asked again whether India would really be prepared to do things for the benefit of Japan or Australia that were not necessarily specifically in its concern. Secondly, as far as Europe is concerned, there is at the present moment a impressive degree of unity, which is really excellent to see, and in particular, a major shift in German policy. I think it's fair to say that there is still a degree of neutralism in this crisis on the part both of some of the Western European governments, I don't think Spain is particularly resolute, for example, against Russia, and also in the case of some of the European political movements, particularly those on both the left and the extreme right. And again, that's a moment of note, and it is something we need to consider. And it would be worth drawing attention to the degree to which, looking forward rather than looking back, all of us can point out, I myself have pointed out, how looking back, much of the criticism of the West advanced on the left and to a degree on the far right has in fact been conducive to President Putin. But looking forward, one needs to consider where we are from that point of view if we are engaging in and confronting a long-term crisis. Now, I think that long-term crisis is one that is going to be the case. It is entirely possible that there may well be a political deal of some type. Russia presumably realizes that it is going to be extraordinarily difficult to subjugate and maintain a subjugation of Ukraine. Russia may, I underline, be willing to accept, after murdering a lot of people, what it regards as limited goals, to wit, Crimea, the Donbass, and Ukraine staying outside of NATO. And it may feel that it is needs to do that because the chance of putting in a protege power, a protege government, rather like the puppet in Belarus, is now of very limited credence. But it has to be said that even if that was the deal, and even if Ukraine, despite its very heavy casualties, could be brought to accept that deal with a regime, a government, Russia, which has literally blood on its hands. Nevertheless, the degree to which either Ukraine or Europe as a whole, however conceived of and constructed and expressed, could have confidence in President Putin maintaining that arrangement is questionable. And on top of that, there would be what one could mildly put open frontiers in Ukraine, in which, on the pattern of what we've already seen in terms of the breakaway parts, Russian linked and Russian backed, there would probably be violence from both sides and a form of implicit conflict. And this may well spread and spread over into places like Moldova, Georgia, Azerbaijan, and indeed NATO powers, particularly Poland and Lithuania. So that then puts us in a very different situation. It would not be realistic for Europeans who might be listening to this to assume that in the medium to long term, the United States is going to put the territorial security of parts of Europe above those of allies in the East Asia Pacific region. It might be nice for Europeans if it did so, but there should be no assumption that it would necessarily do so. And I think it's fair to say that this is very different. You get, obviously, people saying, I've noticed articles saying that this is a resumption of the Cold War after the break from 1989. That's a rather silly remark because, of course, from the perspective of the United States, China is now its most formidable military challenge, whereas obviously in the 1970s and 80s, China was aligned with the United States. So it's a rather shallow analysis. Now, for the Europeans, then, there is the question, what do they understand looking forward Europe to mean in military and political terms? Are they simply going to define it in terms of NATO? If they do, are they prepared to see whatever happens beyond the bounds of NATO? And how are they proposing to stop that spreading into the NATO area. I think that is a very significant set of military and political issues, and it's by no means clear how best that is going to be addressable within the current political structures, looking forward to a situation in which the Americans may not be willing or able to bear the leading burden. So there is a question there for the Europeans. And secondly, and linked to that, a whole range of domestic political initiatives, policies, and suggestions, both within Europe as a whole, whether understood as the European Union or any other definition of Europe, and within individual member countries, are up for reconsideration. The one that has attracted most attention, because it is an immediate issue, is understandably that of energy provision, with all the consequences that holds for so-called green policies, for green political movements that are part of or would be part of coalition governments, obviously part of the German coalition government at the present moment, and also for future fiscal and other economic policies linked to energy provision. Those are obviously consequential, but that is by no means an exhaustive list. There is also the question of agricultural self-sufficiency to a greater extent for Europe's population, much of which is heavily dependent on grain and other food imports. Ukraine, incidentally, is a very major producer and exporter of grain, as well as being a very major producer and exporter of a range of raw materials which are consequential for the Western economy, and which, if Russia acquires, would be of great benefit to the Russian one. Similarly, of course, one can think of Taiwan and the benefit that China would have if it seized its economic and fiscal resources. So there are those issues that need thinking about. And then there are the issues that need thinking about in terms of our attitudes towards, as it were, internal dissent. It would be bizarre to imagine that in the event of a continued crisis, below the level of war between, and we hope certainly there won't be any war between Russia and NATO powers, but it would be bizarre to imagine that Russia would not devote resources, money, cyber attacks, subversion to encouraging movements, whether they're Scottish nationalism, whether they're Catalan separatism, whatever they are, that might well be seen as likely to weaken the West, just as obviously Russia did, or the Soviet Union, I should say, did with its support, either directly or through intermediaries, both in the case of Britain, of the provisional IRA, and of the National Union of Mine Workers. Now, in each of these cases, we saw the problems that those could pose. I think it would be remarkable if we do not see future problems. And that, therefore, should lead us to have all sorts of questions about how best we consider domestic security, domestic stability, and domestic safety in the context of a confrontation with Russia, which may well last, almost certainly will last, long after, hopefully, the murderous attack on Ukraine has stopped. That is what strategic thinking is about. It is not just a matter of moving units around a board as if it was a game of risk. It is a matter of prioritizing in terms of diplomatic, military, and political commitment. And it is a matter also of taking the necessary precautions and launching the necessary initiatives, whether one's thinking of fuel stability or whether one is thinking about trying to ensure mature political debate within societies in which those who quite clearly are aligned with hostile outside powers are not helped any more than can be prevented. The last, obviously, is a difficult issue. I was accused of stirring up a Reds under the beds mentality as a result of a piece in Conservative Home. I've already referred to that, but if I could underline this point. First of all, just for the historical record, there literally were Reds under the bed beds during the so-called Cold War, and they were of enormous benefit to the Soviet Union, most notably in the movement of nuclear technology with all the problems that that posed, but also in many other facets. So there were direct agents, there were bodies that took Soviet arms or money, such as the Provisional IRA, and there was a large number of sympathetic sort of whatever term you wish to use, whether you wish to use the term fellow travellers or whatever you wish to use, who between them helped to cause problems for Western governments, whether one can think, for example, about the attempt to prevent the movement in of cruise and Pershing missiles, whatever terms one wishes to think about this. Now, this situation will probably recur. We already know that there are many in our countries who have limited confidence for our culture, for our civilization, for our traditions, for our means of operation, and who argue that because of supposed or real historic wrongs and supposed or real current disadvantages, we have no moral legitimacy as societies, and therefore presumably are not supposed to oppose other states such as Russia. Some listening to this may feel that that is an entirely reasonable proposition. We're a democracy, so be it. If they can win a majority for that view at the ballot box, that is the view that will prevail. But I think it is fair to say that it is bizarre in the extreme to imagine that one can oppose and seek to build up strength against aggressive and expansionist and warlike and war-making foreign powers without being aware of the fact that there are elements within our own society that give comfort, if not more, to these societies, and which need to be thought through what they entail and how best to, as it were, confront their arguments.
Well, Professor Black, we don't have much time left, but I want to pick up on that last point first, and to, in drawing an analogy with the years of the Cold War, many of those Reds under the beds were committed ideologues to communism, and saw obviously Russia or the Soviet Union as the best means of promoting international communism. What would motivate them now, given that Putin's Russia stands for Russian nationalism?
Oh, I think that's a very easy thing. If, for example, you're a Black Lives Matter advocate arguing that fundamentally Western civilization is based on slavery and capitalism and Enlightenment values, and that all of those are pathologies, then in a way, what you have got is a situation in which Russia appears to be of the same legitimacy, and therefore that opposition to it is wrong and mistaken. Now, I don't agree with that view, but obviously there will be some people that take that view. And as you will be aware, there have been no shortage, still are no shortage of authors who, as it were, juxtapose British history with that of the Third Reich, to argue that there were similarities, which in effect is delegitimating our state and our society.
Mm-hmm. And a question which really I think springs from Kissinger's famous claim that you mentioned about him, you're wanting to have one person to call in Europe. On the one hand, I think it's your position that European defence cannot be successful within Europe without the heft that the United States brings. So if the United States regards Europe as a very much a secondary theatre, focusing on China, and leaves it to Europe, Europe will struggle to fill that void. But from the perspective in Paris and Brussels and perhaps Berlin, is it that, well, actually, Europe can't count on America in the future? There could be a Republican government led by Donald Trump next time. It's distinctly possible. It's difficult to foretell what Trump's attitude would be in the event of further Russian aggression in the continent of Europe. And that, nevertheless, Europe has to pick up that slack. Is it realistic for Europe to attempt to double guess the future of American policy with regard to Europe?
Well, I think that's a very good question. I mean, I made the point in our last discussion that if Donald Trump wins the next presidential election, then Vladimir Putin may well consider his geopolitical goal of the destruction or emasculation of NATO as achieved. So I would still stand by that. I'm not saying that there aren't other reasons to be wary of Mr. Trump, but I actually think his foreign policy position is not helpful. Let's just put it bluntly like that. If by what you were saying is that the Europeans, knowing that America is unpredictable and knowing that America has other priorities, may well go in other directions. They may well seek to appease Russia and China, which in effect was German policy from Ostpolitik onwards until, as it were, yesterday, or they may well, as it were, finally wake up to the situation that they're in and think about what they can realistically do. I simply don't know, and I would be foolish to pretend otherwise. But what I think is certainly the case is that the present crisis demonstrates the extent to which power is the ultimate force in international relations. It would be nice to think that ideas were swearing the force of ideas and of good intentions elsewhere were in some way weakening President Putin. But it's worth noting that what the West has in fact relied on is power of a different form, principally financial power and economic power. And this notion that, as it were, the real issues of international relations relate ultimately to politics, to war, to economic heft, to military strength, is one that is culturally important for us to engage with, not least because it's worth saying that in a West where identity politics is to the fore, we do, and it's easy to understand why others can see us in this light, we do seem to be a culture which, to put it mildly, is more attractive than that of the state-sponsored culture of Russia, but also very weak in terms of confronting it.
Well, we must leave it there. But Professor Jeremy Black, for bringing us up to date with the state of geopolitics in the light of the invasion of Ukraine, thank you very much indeed.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.